This is community-supported radio WDRT, Viroqua, 91.9 FM, and on the internet, wdrt.org.
Good evening, and welcome to Carousel. Each Sunday evening at this time, WDRT offers original programming that highlights the lively arts. Rotating on a weekly basis, we present a variety of live music, radio theater, spoken word, original fiction, poetry, and performance art. Each week's selection is presented by talented local volunteers who offer you a unique experience with the artistic talent found here in the Driftless. Now sit back and enjoy this week's performance. Welcome to Carousel on WDRT.
Welcome to Old Hills Radio. I'm Carl, and for the next hour, you'll hear two American stories on this pre-recorded program. First to roll is Sherman Alexie's What You Pawn, I Will Redeem. Follow Jackson Jackson's quest to honestly reclaim his grandmother's stolen powwow regalia from a pawn shop operator. Then we present The Great Mountains by Steinbeck, a young boy on his parents' ranch who is mystified by an ageless man who appears and then declares an intention to die on the rancho where he was born. What will be the old man's fate? Stick with us for an hour. Now it's What You Pawn, I Will Redeem.
One day you have a home and the next day you don't. But I'm not going to tell you my particular reasons for being homeless because it's my secret story, and Indians have to work hard to keep secrets from hungry white folks. I'm a Spokane Indian boy and Interior Salish, and my people have lived within a 100-mile radius of Spokane, Washington, for at least 10,000 years. I grew up in Spokane, moved to Seattle 23 years ago for college, flunked out within two semesters, worked various blue and bluer-collar jobs for many years, married two or three times, fathered two or three kids. I've broken a few hearts in my time, but we've all done that, so I'm nothing special in that regard. I'm a boring heartbreaker at that because I've never abandoned one woman for another. I've never dated or married more than one woman at a time. I didn't break hearts into pieces overnight. I broke them slowly and carefully. I didn't set any land speed records running out the door. Piece by piece, I disappeared, and I've been disappearing ever since. But I'm not going to tell you any more about my brain or my soul. I've been homeless for 6 years. If there's such a thing as being an effective homeless man, I suppose I'm effective. Probably none of this interests you. I probably don't interest you much. Homeless Indians are everywhere in Seattle. I wander the streets with a regular crew. It's Rose, Junior, and me. Rose is a big woman, about 7 feet tall if you're measuring overall effect, and about 5 feet tall if you're talking about the physical. She's a Yakima Indian of the Wishram variety. Junior is a Colville. He's good-looking, like he just stepped out of some Don't Litter the Earth public service announcement. He's got one of those great big cheekbones that are like planets. He gets me jealous. If you put Junior and me next to each other, he's the before Columbus arrived Indian, and I'm the after Columbus arrived Indian. I'm living proof of the horrible damage that colonialism has done to us skins. The whole story started at lunchtime when Rose, Jr., and I were panhandling down at Pike Place Market. After about 2 hours, we earned $5, good enough for a bottle of fortified courage from the most beautiful 7-Eleven in the world. So we headed over that way, feeling like warrior drunks, and we walked past this pawn shop I had never noticed before. And that was strange, because we Indians have built-in pawn shop radar. But the strangest thing was the old powwow dance regalia I saw hanging in the window. That's my grandmother's regalia.
How do you know for sure?
I didn't know for sure because I hadn't seen that regalia in person ever. I had seen only photographs of my grandmother dancing in it, and that was before somebody stole it from her 50 years ago. But it sure looked like my memory of it, and it had all the same colors of feathers and beads that my family always sewed into their powwow regalia. There's only one way to know for sure. So Rose, Junior, and I walked into the pawn shop and greeted the old white man working behind the counter.
How can I help you?
That's my grandmother's powwow regalia in your window. Somebody stole it from her 50 years ago, and my family has been looking for it ever since. The pawnbroker looked at me like I was a liar. I'm not lying. Ask my friends. They'll tell you.
He's the most honest Indian I know.
All right, honest Indian, I'll give you the benefit of the doubt. Can you prove it's your grandmother's regalia?
Because they don't want to be perfect, because only God is perfect. Indian people sew flaws into their powwow regalia. My family always sewed one yellow bead somewhere on their regalia, but we always hid it where you had to search hard to find it. If it really is my grandmother's, there will be one yellow bead hidden somewhere on it.
All right. Then let's take a look.
He pulled the regalia out of the window, and we searched for that yellow bead and found it hidden beneath the armpit.
There it is. You are right. This is your grandmother's regalia.
It's been missing for 50 years.
That's his family. Sad story. Are you going to give it back to him?
That would be the right thing to do, but I can't afford to do the right thing. I paid $1,000 for this. And I can't give away $1,000.
Well, you could go to the cops and tell them it was stolen.
Well, hey, now, don't go threatening people.
Well, I suppose you could go to the cops, but I don't think they'd believe a word you said. What's your name?
Jackson.
Is that first or last?
Both.
Are you serious?
Yes, it's true. My mother and father named me Jackson Jackson. My family nickname is Jackson Squared.
All right, Jackson, Jackson. You wouldn't happen to have $1,000, would you?
We got $5 total.
That's too bad. For $1,000, I'd sell it to you, if you had it. Heck, I'd make it fair. I'd sell it to you for $999. I'd lose a dollar. It would be the moral thing to do in this case, to lose a dollar, to do the right thing.
We got $5 total.
That's too bad. How about this? I give you 24 hours to come up with $999. You come back here at lunchtime tomorrow with the money, and I'll sell it back to you. How's that sound?
Sounds good.
All right, then. We have a deal. And I'll get you started. Here's 20 bucks to get you started.
He opened up his wallet and put out a crisp $20 bill and gave it to me. Rose, Junior, and I walked out into the daylight to search for $974 more dollars. We carried our $20 bill and our $5 in loose change over to the 7-Eleven and spent it to buy 3 bottles of imagination. Thinking hard, we huddled in an alley beneath the Alaska Way Viaduct and finished off those bottles 1, 2, and 3. Rose was gone when I awoke. I heard later she had hitchhiked back to the reservation. Junior was passed out beside me, covered in his own vomit, and my head hurt from thinking. So I left him alone and walked down to the water. I love the smell of ocean water. Salt always smells like memory. When I got to the wharf, I ran into 3 Aleut cousins who sat on a wooden bench and stared out at the bay and cried. Most of the homeless Indians in Seattle come from Alaska, one by one. Each of them hopped a big working boat in Anchorage or Barrow or Juneau, fished his way south to Seattle, jumped off the boat with a pocket full of cash to party hard at one of the Indian bars, went broke and broker, and has been trying to find his way back to that boat and the frozen north ever since. These Aleuts smelled like salmon, I thought. Then they told me they were going to sit out on that wooden bench until their boat came back. How long's your boat been gone?
11 years.
I cried with them for a while. Hey, you guys have any money I can borrow? They didn't. I walked back to Junior. He was still passed out. I put my face down near his mouth to make sure he was breathing. He was alive, so I dug around in his blue jean pockets and found half a cigarette. I smoked it all the way down. and thought about my grandmother. Her name was Agnes, and she died of breast cancer when I was 14. My father thought Agnes caught her tumors from the uranium mine on the reservation, but my mother said the disease started when Agnes was walking back from the powwow one night and got run over by a motorcycle. She broke 3 ribs, and tumors always take over when you don't heal right. I wondered if my grandmother's cancer had started when somebody stole her powwow regalia. Maybe the cancer started in her broken heart and then leaked out into her breasts. I know it's crazy, but I wondered if I could bring my grandmother back to life if I bought back the regalia. I needed money, big money. So I left Junior and walked over to the Regal Change office. They publish a newspaper. I sometimes sell it on the streets, but you have to stay sober to sell it, and I'm not always good at staying sober. Anybody can sell a newspaper. You buy each copy for 30 cents and sell it for a dollar and keep the net profit. I need 1,430 papers.
Well, that's a strange number, and that's a lot of papers.
I need them.
It will cost you $429 for that many.
If I had that kind of money, I wouldn't need to sell the papers.
What's going on, Jackson, to the second power?
I told him about my grandmother's powwow regalia and how much money I needed to buy it back.
We should call the police.
No, I don't want to do that. It's a quest now. I need to win it back by myself.
I understand, and to be honest, I'd give you the papers to sell if I thought it would work, but the record for most papers sold in a day by one vendor is only 302.
That would net me about $200.
$211.40.
Yeah, that's not enough.
The most money anybody has made in one day is $525, and that's because somebody gave Old Blue $500 bills for some dang reason. The average daily net is about $30.
Yeah, this isn't going to work.
No?
No. Can you lend me some money?
I can't do that. If I lend you money, I have to lend money to everybody.
Hey, what can you do?
I'll give you 50 papers for free. But don't tell anybody I did it.
Okay. He gathered up the newspapers and handed them to me. I sold 5 in 1 hour, dumped the other 45 into a garbage can, and walked into the McDonald's, ordered 4 cheeseburgers for $1 each, and slowly ate them. After eating, I walked outside and vomited on the sidewalk. I hated to lose my food so soon after eating it. As an alcoholic Indian with a busted stomach, I always hope I can keep enough food in my stomach to stay alive. With $1 in my pocket, I walked back to Junior. He was still passed out, so I put my ear to his chest and listened for his heartbeat. He was alive. So I took off his shoes and socks and found $1 in his left sock and 50 cents in his right sock. With $2.50 in my hand, I sat beside Junior and thought about my grandmother and her stories. When I was 16, my grandmother told me a story about World War II. She was a nurse at a military hospital in Sydney, Australia. Over the course of 2 years, she comforted and healed U.S. and Australian soldiers. One day, she tended to a wounded Maori soldier. He was very dark skinned. His hair was black and curly, and his eyes were black and warm. His face was covered with bright tattoos.
Are you Maori?
No, I'm Spokane Indian from the United States.
Ah, yes, I've heard of your tribes, but you're the first American Indian I've met.
There's a lot of Indian soldiers fighting for the United States. I have a brother still fighting in Germany, and I lost another brother on Okinawa.
I am sorry. I was on Okinawa as well. It was terrible. That's where I lost my legs in an artillery attack.
I'm sorry about your legs.
It's funny, isn't it?
What's funny?
How we brown people are killing other brown people so white people will remain free.
I hadn't thought of it that way.
Well, sometimes I think of it that way, and other times I think of it the way they want me to think of it. I get confused.
I'll give you some more morphine.
Do you believe in heaven?
Which heaven?
I'm talking about the heaven where my legs are waiting for me. Of course. My legs will probably run away from me when I get to heaven. And how will I ever catch them?
You have to get your arms strong so you can run on your hands.
They laughed again. Sitting beside Junior, I laughed with the memory of my grandmother's story. I put my hand close to Junior's mouth to make sure he was still breathing. Yes, Junior was alive. So I took his $2.50 and walked to the Korean grocery store, where I bought a 50-cent cigar and two scratch lottery tickets for $1 each. The maximum cash prize was $500 a ticket. If I won both, I would have enough money to buy back the regalia. And I loved Kay, the young Korean woman who worked the register. She was the daughter of the owners and sang all day. I love you, Kay.
You always say you love me.
That's because I will always love you.
You are a sentimental fool.
I am a romantic old man.
But too old for me.
I know I'm too old for you, but I can dream.
Okay, I agree to be part of your dreams, but I will only hold your hands in your dreams. No kissing and no sex, not even in your dreams.
Okay, no sex, just romance.
Goodbye, Jackson. Jackson, my love, I will see you soon.
I left the store and walked over to Occidental Park, sat on a bench, and smoked my cigar all the way down. Then I scratched my first lottery ticket and won nothing. So I could win only $500 now, and that would be just half of what I needed. 10 minutes later, I scratched my other lottery ticket and won a free ticket, a small consolation, and one more chance to win money. I walked back to Kay.
Jackson, Jackson, have you come back to claim my heart?
I won a free ticket.
Just like a man, you love money and power more than you love me.
It's true, and I'm sorry it's true. She gave me another scratch ticket, and I carried it outside. I like to scratch my tickets in private. Hopeful and sad, I scratched the third ticket and won real money. I carried it back inside to Kay. I won $100.
Oh, that's a fortune. And here are 5 twenties.
Thank you. And here's one of the twenties.
I can't take that. It's your money.
No, it's tribal. It's an Indian thing. When you win, you're supposed to share with your family.
I'm not your family.
Yes, you are. She smiled. She kept the money. With $80 in my pocket, I said goodbye to my dear Kay and walked out into the cold night. I wanted to share the good news with Junior. I walked back to him, but he was gone. I later heard that he had hitchhiked down to Portland, Oregon, and died of exposure in an alley behind the Hilton Hotel. Lonely for Indians, I carried my $80 over to Big Hearts in South Downtown. Big Hearts is an all-Indian bar. I walked inside and counted 15 Indians, 8 men and 7 women. I didn't know any of them, but Indians like to belong, so we all pretended to be cousins. Hey, bartender, how much for whiskey shots?
You want the bad stuff or the badder stuff?
As bad as you've got.
$1 a shot.
All right, here's my $80. Me and all my cousins here are going to be drinking 80 shots. That's 5 drinks for everybody. We all laughed. We drank our whiskey shots until they were gone, but the other Indians bought me more whiskey shots because I had been so generous with my money. Nearly blind with alcohol, I stood alone at the bar. One more shot, bartender.
You've got no more money.
Somebody buy me a drink.
They've got no more money either.
Where are all my cousins?
Long gone, and it's closing time.
Where'd they go?
I told you 100 times. I don't know.
What am I supposed to do?
It's closing time. I don't care where you go, but you're not staying here.
You are ungrateful. I've been good to you.
You don't leave right now. I'm going to kick your butt.
Okay, come on. I know how to fight. He came for me. I don't remember what happened after that. I emerged from the blackness and discovered myself walking behind a big warehouse. I didn't know where I was. My face hurt. I touched my nose and decided it might be broken. Exhausted and cold, I pulled a plastic tarp from a truck bed, wrapped it around me, and fell asleep in the dirt. Then somebody kicked me in the ribs. I opened my eyes and looked up at a white cop.
Jackson, is that you?
Officer Williams. He was a good cop with a sweet tooth. He'd given me hundreds of candy bars over the years. I wonder if he knew I was diabetic.
What the hell are you doing here?
I was cold and sleepy, so I laid down.
You dumb, silly man. You passed out on the railroad tracks.
I sat up and looked around. I was lying on the railroad tracks. Dock workers stared at me. I should have been a railroad track pizza. Sick and scared, I leaned over and puked whiskey.
What's wrong with you? You've never been like this. This stupid.
It's my grandmother. She died.
I'm sorry, man. When did she die?
1972.
And you're killing yourself now?
I've been killing myself ever since she died.
And somebody beat the hell out of you. You remember who?
Mr. Grief. And I went a few rounds.
It looks like Mr. Grief knocked you out.
Mr. Grief always wins.
Come on. Let's get you out of here. Now get in my squad car. But if you throw up in here, you're cleaning it up.
Okay, that's fair.
I'm taking you over to detox.
No, man, that place is awful. It's full of drunk Indians. We laughed.
I don't know how you guys do it.
What guys?
You Indians. How the hell you laugh so much? I just picked you off the railroad tracks and you're making jokes. Why the hell do you do that?
Hey, the two funniest tribes I've ever been around are Indians and Jews. So I guess that says something about the inherent humor of genocide, huh?
Listen to you, Jackson. You're smart. Why the hell are you on the streets?
Give me $1,000 and I'll tell you.
You bet I'd give you $1,000 if I knew it'd straighten you and your life right up.
No, you're a good cop.
Come on, Jackson. Don't blow smoke.
No, really. You remind me of my grandfather.
Yeah, that's what you Indians always tell me.
No, man. My grandfather was a tribal cop. He was a good cop. He never arrested people. He took care of them. Just like you.
I've arrested hundreds of scumbags, Jackson, and I've shot a couple.
It don't matter. You are not a killer.
I didn't kill them.
We drove through downtown. The missions and shelters had already released their overnighters. Sleepy homeless men and women stood on corners and stared up at the gray sky. Did you ever get scared?
What do you mean?
I mean, being a cop, is it scary?
I guess I try not to think too much about being afraid. If you think about fear, then you'll be afraid. The job is boring most of the time, just driving and looking into dark corners, you know, and seeing nothing, but then things get heavy. You're chasing somebody or fighting them or walking around a dark house and you just know some crazy guy is hiding around a corner, and hell yes, it's scary.
Yeah, my grandfather was killed in the line of duty.
I'm sorry. How did it happen?
He worked on the reservation. Everybody knew everybody. It was safe. We weren't like those crazy Sioux or Apache or any of those other warrior tribes. There's only been 3 murders on my reservation in the last 100 years.
That's safe.
Yeah, well, we Spokane, we're passive, you know. We're mean with words, and we'll cuss out anybody, but we don't shoot people. Or stab them. I mean, not much, anyway.
So what happened to your grandfather?
Now, this man and his girlfriend were fighting down by Little Falls.
Domestic dispute. Those are the worst.
Yeah, but this guy was my grandfather's brother.
Oh,
my great-uncle.
No.
Yeah, it was awful.
No.
My grandfather just strolled into the house. He'd been there 1,000 times, and his brother and his girlfriend were all drunk and beating on each other. And my grandfather stepped between them just like he'd done 100 times before. And the girlfriend tripped or something. She fell down and hit her head and started crying. And my grandfather knelt down beside her to make sure she was all right. And for some reason, my great uncle, he reached down, pulled my grandfather's pistol out of his holster and shot him in the head.
That's terrible. I'm sorry.
Yeah. My great uncle, you could never figure out why he did it. He went to prison forever, you know. And he always wrote these long letters. And he was always trying to figure out why he did it.
Do you remember your grandfather?
A little bit. I remember the funeral. My grandmother wouldn't let them bury him. My father had to drag her away from the grave.
I don't know what to say.
I don't either. We stopped in front of the detox center.
We're here.
I can't go in there.
You have to.
Please, no. They'll keep me for 24 hours. And then it'll be too late.
Too late for what?
My grandmother's regalia was stolen, and the deadline for buying it back is noon today. I need $1,000.
If it was stolen, then You need to file reports. I'll investigate it myself. If that thing is really your grandmother's, I'll get it back for you, legally.
No. No, that's not fair. The pawnbroker did not know it was stolen. And besides, I'm on a mission here. I want to be a hero, you know? I want to win it back like a knight.
That's romantic crap.
It might be, but I care about it. It's been a long time since I really cared about something.
I'll give you some money. I don't have much, only $30. I'm short until payday, and it's not enough to get back the regalia, but it's something.
I'll take it.
I'm giving it to you because I believe in what you believe. I'm hoping, I don't know why I'm hoping it, but I'm hoping you can turn $30 into $1,000 somehow.
I believe in magic.
I believe you'll take my money and get drunk on it.
Then why are you giving it to me?
There ain't no such thing as an atheist cop.
Sure there is.
Yeah? Well, I'm not an atheist cop. Here's 2 fives and a $20. Take care of yourself, Jackson. Stay off the railroad tracks.
I'll try. He drove away. Carrying my money, I headed back toward the water. On the wharf, those three Aleut men still waited on the wooden bench. Have you seen your ships?
Seen a lot of ships, but not our ship.
I sat on the bench with them. We sat in silence for a long time. I thought about my grandmother. I'd never seen her dance in her regalia. More than anything, I'd wished I'd seen her dance at a powwow. Hey, do you guys know any songs?
I know all of Hank Williams.
How about Indian songs?
Hank Williams is Indian.
How about sacred songs?
Hank Williams is sacred.
I'm talking about ceremonial songs, you know, religious ones, the songs you sing back home when you're wishing and hoping.
What are you wishing and hoping for?
I'm wishing my grandmother was still alive.
Every song I know is about that.
Well, sing me as many as you can. The Aleuts sang their strange and beautiful songs. I listened. They sang about my grandmother and their grandmothers. They were lonely for the cold and snow. After they had finished their last song, we sat in silence. Indians are good at silence. Was that the last song?
Yeah. We sang all the ones we could. All the others are just for our people.
I understood. We Indians have to keep our secrets. And these Aleuts were so secretive that they didn't refer to themselves as Indians. Hey, you guys hungry? They looked at one another and communicated without talking.
We could eat.
The Aleuts and I walked over to Mother's Kitchen, a greasy diner in the International District.
Four for breakfast.
Yes, we're very hungry.
You guys want summer checks?
No, I'm paying for it.
Well, aren't you the generous one?
Well, don't do that.
Do what?
Don't ask me rhetorical questions. They scare me.
Okay, Professor. I'll only ask you real questions from now on.
Thank you.
What do you guys want to eat?
That's the best question anybody could ask anybody.
How much money you got?
Another good question. I've got $25 I can spend. Bring us all the breakfast you can, plus your tip.
All right. That's 4 specials and 4 coffees and 15% for me.
The Aleuts and I waited in silence. Soon enough, the waitress returned and poured us 4 coffees, and we sipped at them until she returned again with 4 plates of food, eggs, bacon, toast, hash brown potatoes. It's amazing how much food you can buy for so little money. Grateful, we feasted. I said farewell to the Aleuts and walked toward the pawn shop. I later heard that they had waded into the salt water near Dock 47 and disappeared. Some Indians said the Aleuts walked on the water and headed north. Other Indians saw the Aleuts drown. I don't know what happened to them. I looked for the pawn shop and couldn't find it. I swear it was located in the place where I had been before. I walked 20 or 30 blocks, but that pawn shop seemed to have sailed away from me like a ghost ship. I wanted to cry. Right when I'd given up, there it was, located in a space I swore it hadn't been filling up a few minutes before. I walked inside and greeted the pawnbroker.
It's you.
Yes, it's me.
Jackson Jackson.
That is my name.
Where are your friends?
They went traveling. But it's okay. Indians are everywhere.
You have my money.
How much do I need again?
$999.
I don't have that.
What do you have?
$5.
Is it the same $5 from yesterday?
No, it's different.
Did you work hard for this money?
Yes.
Well, here's your grandmother's regalia. Now, take it.
I don't have the money.
I don't want your money.
But I wanted to win it.
You did win it. Now take it before I change my mind.
Do you know how many good men live in this world? Too many to count. I took my grandmother's regalia and walked outside. I knew that solitary yellow bead was part of me. I knew I was that yellow bead in part. Outside, I wrapped myself in my grandmother's regalia and breathed her in. I stepped off the sidewalk and into the intersection. Pedestrians stopped. Cars stopped. The city stopped. They all watched me dance with my grandmother. I was my grandmother dancing.
That was Sherman Alexie's What You Pawn, I Will Redeem, produced and recorded live at WDRT Viroqua in June of 2014 with Adam Fogelson, Kat Tigerman, Carl Schlecht, and with Rusty James as audio engineer, adapted for radio by Kat Tigerman. Now, to finish, it's The Great Mountains by Steinbeck, in a tale of a young boy's fascination in the coastal high chaparral in California.
In the humming heat of a midsummer afternoon, the little boy, Jody, listlessly looked about the ranch for something to do. He had been to the barn. He had thrown rocks at the swallows. He had baited a rat trap with stale cheese and set it where Doubletree Mutt, that good big old dog, would get his nose snapped. Jody was not moved by an impulse of cruelty. He was bored with the long, hot afternoon, and Doubletree Mutt put his stupid nose in the trap and got it smacked. And no matter where he was hurt, Mutt limped. It must just be because once when he was young, Mutt got caught in a coyote trap, and always after that, he limped. Even when he was scolded. When Mutt yelped, Jody's mother called from inside the house, "Jody, stop torturing that dog and find something to do." Then he took a slingshot from the porch and walked up towards the brush line to try to kill a bird. He walked up through the vegetable patch, kicking his bare toes into the dust, and on the way he found the perfect slingshot stone. He fitted it into the leather pouch of his weapon and proceeded to the brush line. For the first time that afternoon, he was intent. In the shade of the sagebrush, the little birds were working, scratching in the leaves. Jody pulled back the rubbers on the sling. One little thrush paused and looked at him and crouched, ready to fly. When he was 20 feet away, he carefully raised the sling and aimed it. The thrush started up and flew right into it, and down the little bird went with a broken head. Jody ran to it and picked it up. "Well, I got you," he said. The bird looked much smaller dead than it was alive. He didn't care about the bird or its life, but he knew what older people would say if they had seen him kill it. He decided to forget the whole thing as quickly as he could and never to mention it. The hills were dry at this season, but where the spring pipe filled the round tub lay a stretch of fine green grass. Jody drank from the mossy tub. Then he lay on his back in the grass and looked up at the dumpling summer clouds. By closing one eye, he brought them down within reach so that he could put up his fingers and stroke them. It seemed to him that they went faster for his help. One fat white cloud he helped clear to the mountain's rim and pressed it firmly out of sight. Jody wondered it was seeing then. He sat up to better look at the great mountains, where they went piling back with one jagged ridge high up against the west. Curious, secret mountains. "What's on the other side?" he asked his father once. "More mountains, I guess. Why?" "And on the other side of them? More mountains. Why?" "More mountains? On and on?" "Well, no. At last you come to the ocean." "But what's in the mountains?" "Just cliffs and brush and rocks and dryness." "Were you ever there?" "No." Has anybody ever been there?" "A few people, I guess. It's dangerous. Why, I've read there's more unexplored country in the mountains of Monterey County than in any place in the United States." "And at last the ocean?" "At last the ocean. But in between, no one knows?" "Oh, a few people do, I guess. But there's nothing there to get and not much water, just rocks. Why?" "It would be good to go." "What for? There's nothing there." Jody knew something was there. "Something secret and mysterious," he said to his mother. "Do you know what's in the big mountains?" She looked at him and then back at the ferocious range, and she said, "Only a bear, I guess." "What bear?" "Why, the one that went over the mountains to see what he could see." Jody questioned Billy Buck, the ranch hand, about the possibility of ancient cities lost in the mountains, but Billy agreed with Jody's father.
"It ain't likely. There'd be nothing to eat unless a kind of people that can eat rocks live there."
That information made the mountains dear to him and terrible. He thought often of the miles of ridge after ridge until at last there was the sea. When the peaks were pink in the morning, they invited him among them. And when the sun had gone over the edge in the evening and the mountains were a purple like despair, then Jody was afraid of them. Now he turned towards the mountains of the east, the Gobelins. They were jolly mountains with hill ranches and with pine trees growing on their crests. People lived there, and battles had been fought against the Mexicans on the slopes. He looked back for an instant at the great mountains and shivered. The home ranch below him was sunny and safe. The house gleamed with white, and the barn was brown and warm. The red cows on the farther hill ate their way slowly toward the north. Chickens scratched about in the dust of the farmyard and with quick waltzing steps. Then a moving figure caught Jody's eye. A man walked slowly over the brow of the hill on the road from Salinas, and he was headed toward the house. Jody moved down toward the house, too. He wanted to be there to see. By the time the boy got to the house, Jody could tell he was old, but only because his heels struck the ground with hard jerks. Jody saw that he was dressed in blue jeans and in a coat made of the same material. He wore clodhopper shoes and an old flat-brimmed Stetson hat. He carried a gunny sack, lumpy and full. In a few moments, he had trudged close, and his face was as dark as dried beef. A mustache blew white against the dark skin, and his hair was white. The skin of his face had shrunk back against the skull until it defined bone, not flesh, and made the nose and chin seem sharp and fragile. The eyes were large and deep and dark, with eyelids stretched tightly over them. Irises and pupils were one and very black, but the eyeballs were brown. There were no wrinkles in the face at all. This old man wore a blue denim coat buttoned to the throat. Out of the sleeves came strong, bony wrists. The old man drew close to the gate and swung down his sack when he confronted Jody.
Do you live here?
Jody was embarrassed. He turned and looked at the house, and he turned back and looked toward the barn where his father and Billy Buck were.
Yes,
he said.
I have come back. I am Gitano, and I have come back.
Jody turned abruptly and ran into the house for help, and the screen door banged after him. His mother was in the kitchen.
It's an old man. It's an old paisano man. And he says he's come back.
What's the matter now? His mother asked patiently.
It's an old man outside. Come on out.
Well, what does he want? She untied the strings of her apron and smoothed her hair with her fingers.
I don't know. He came walking.
His mother went out, and Jody followed her. Gitano had not moved.
Yes?
Mrs. Tiflin asked. Gitano took off his old black hat and held it with both hands in front of him. He repeated,
I am Gitano. I have come back. Come back? Back from where?
Gitano's whole straight body leaned forward a little. His right hand described the circle of the hills, the sloping fields, and the mountains, and ended at his hat again.
Back to the rancho. I was born here, and my father too.
Here? This isn't an old place.
No, there,
he said, pointing to the western ridge.
On the other side, there, in a house that is gone. The old adobe that's washed almost away, you mean? Yes, signora. When the rancho broke up, they put no more lime on the adobe, and the rains washed it down.
Jody's mother was silent, curious. Homesick thoughts ran through her mind, but quickly she cleared them out. And
what do you want here now, Gitano? I will stay here until I die. But we don't need an extra man here. I cannot work any more, signora. I can milk a cow, feed chickens, cut a little wood, no more. I will stay here.
She turned to Jody. Run down to the barn and call your father. Jody dashed away and returned with Carl Tiflin and Billy Buck behind him. The old man was standing as he had been, but he was resting now. His whole body had sagged into a timeless repose. What is it? Carl Tiflin asked. What's Jody so excited about?
He wants to stay here. He wants to do a little work and stay here.
Well, we can't have him. We don't need any more men. He's too old.
Billy does everything we need.
Suddenly, they both hesitated and looked at Gitano and were embarrassed.
I am too old to work. I come back where I was born.
You weren't born here, Carl said sharply.
No, in the Dobie house over the hill. It was all one rancho before you came.
In the mud house. That's all melted down?
Yes, I and my father. I will stay here now on the rancho.
I tell you, you won't stay. I don't need any old man. This isn't a big ranch. I can't afford food and doctor bills for an old man. You must have relatives and friends. Go to them. It's like begging to come to strangers.
I was born here.
Carl Tiflin didn't like to be cruel, but he felt he must. You can eat here tonight. You can sleep in the little room of the old bunkhouse. We'll give you your breakfast in the morning. Then you go to your friends. Don't come to die with strangers. Gitano put his black hat on, and he stooped for his sack.
Here are my things.
Carl turned away. Come on, Billy, we'll finish at the barn. Jody, show him the little room in the bunkhouse. He and Billy turned back towards the barn. Mrs. Tiflin went into the house, saying over her shoulder,
I'll send some blankets down.
Gitano looked questioningly at Jody.
I'll show you where it is, Jody said.
There was a cot with a shuck mattress, an apple box holding a tin lantern, and a backless rocking chair in the little room of the bunkhouse. Gaetano laid his sack carefully on the floor and sat down on the bed. Jody stood shyly in the room, hesitating to go. At last he said, "Do you come from the big mountains?" Gaetano shook his head slowly. "No, I worked down the Salinas Valley." The afternoon thought would not let Jody go. "Did you ever go into the big mountains back there?" The old dark eyes grew fixed and their light turned inward on the years that were living in Gaetano's head. "Once when I was a little boy, I went with my father." "Way back into the mountains?" "Yes. What was there? Did you see any people or any houses?" "No." "Well, what was there?" Gaetano's eyes remained inward. A little wrinkled strain came between his brows. "What did you see in there?" "I don't know. I don't remember." "Was it terrible and dry?" "I don't remember." In his excitement, Jody had lost his shyness. "Don't you remember anything about it?" Gaetano's mouth opened for a word and remained open while his brain sought the word. "I think it was quiet. I think it was nice." Gaetano's eyes seemed to have found something back in the years, for they grew soft and a little smile seemed to go in them. "Didn't you ever go back in the mountains again?" "No." "Didn't you ever want to?" But now Gaetano's face became impatient. "No," he said in a tone that told Jody he didn't want to talk about it anymore. The boy was held by a curious fascination. He didn't want to go away from Gaetano. His shyness returned. "Would you like to come down to the barn and see the stock?" he asked. Gaetano stood up, put on his hat, and prepared to follow. It was almost evening now. They stood near the watering trough while the horses sauntered in from the hillsides for an evening drink. Gaetano rested his big twisted hands on the top rail of the fence. 5 horses came down and drank. Long after they had finished drinking, an old horse appeared over the brow of the hill and came painfully down. It had long yellow teeth, and its ribs and hip bones jutted out under its skin. It hobbled up and with a loud sucking noise began to drink. "That's old Easter. That's the first horse my father ever had. He's 30 years old." He looked up into Gaetano's eyes, old eyes, for some response. "No good anymore." Josie's father and Billy Buck came out of the barn and walked over. "Too old to work. Just eats and pretty soon dies." Carl Tiflin caught the last words. He hated his brutality towards the old Gaetano, and so he became brutal again. "It's a shame not to shoot Easter. It'd save him a lot of pains and rheumatism." He looked secretly at Gaetano. "Old things ought to be put out of their misery. One shot, a big noise, one big pain in the head, maybe that's all. That's better than stiffness and sore teeth." Billy Buck broke in. "They got a right to rest after all the work they did all their life." Carl had been looking at the skinny horse. "You can't imagine now what Easter used to look like. High neck, deep chest, fine barrel. He could jump a 5-bar gate in a stride. I won a flat race on him when I was 15 years old. I could have got $200 for him any time. You wouldn't think how pretty he was. But he ought to be shot now." "He's got a right to rest," Billy Buck insisted. Jody's father had a humorous thought. He turned to Gaetano. "If ham and eggs grew on a hillside, I'd turn you out to pasture too, but
I can't afford to pasture you in my kitchen.
He laughed to Billy Buck about it as they walked towards the house.
Be a good thing for all of us if ham and eggs grew on the side hills.
Jody knew how his father was probing for a place to hurt in Gitano. He had been probed often. His father knew every place in the boy where a word would fester.
He's only talking. He didn't mean it about shooting Easter. He likes Easter. That was the first horse he ever owned.
The sun sank behind the mountains as they stood there, and the ranch was hushed. Gitano seemed to be more at home in the evening. He made a curious sharp sound with his lips and stretched one of his hands over the fence. Old Easter moved stiffly to him, and Gitano rubbed the lean neck under his name.
You like him? Jody asked.
Yes, but he's no damn good. The triangle sounded.
That's supper, Jody cried. Come on, to supper.
As they walked up towards the house, Jody noticed again that Gitano's body was as straight as that of a young man. Only the jerkiness of his movements and by the scuffling of his heels could it be seen that he was old. The turkeys were flying heavily into the lower branches of the cypress trees by the bunkhouse. A fat, sleek ranch cat walked across the road carrying a rat so large its tail dragged on the ground. The quail on the side hills were still sounding the clear water call. Jody and Gitano came to the back steps, and Mrs. Tiflin looked out through the screen door at them.
Come running, Jody. Come in to supper, Gitano.
Carl and Billy Buck had started to eat at the long oilcloth-covered table. Jody slipped into his chair without moving it, but Gitano stood holding his hat until Carl looked up and said, sit down, You might as well get your belly full before you go on. Carl was afraid he might relent and let the old man stay, so he continued to remind himself that this couldn't be. Gitano laid his hat on the floor and diffidently sat down. He wouldn't reach for food. Carl had to pass it to him.
Here, fill yourself up.
Gitano ate very slowly, cutting tiny pieces of meat and arranging little pats of mashed potatoes on his plate. The situation would not stop worrying Carl Tiflin.
Haven't you got any relatives in this part of the country? He asked.
Gitano answered with some pride.
My brother-in-law is in Monterey. I have cousins there, too. Well, you can go there and live with them. I was born here.
Jody's mother came in the room carrying a large bowl of tapioca pudding. Carl chuckled to her.
Did I tell you what I said to him? I said if ham and eggs grew on the side hills, I'd put him out to pasture like old Easter.
Gitano stared unmoved at his plate. It's too bad he can't stay, said Mrs. Tiflin.
Now, don't start anything, Carl said crossly.
When they finished eating, Carl and Billy, Buck and Jody went into the living room to sit for a while, but Gitano, without a word of farewell or thanks, walked through the kitchen and out the back door. Jody sat secretly and watched his father. He knew how mean his father felt.
This country is full of old paisanos. They're damn good men, Billy defended. They can work older than a white man. I saw one of them 105 years old, and he could still ride a horse. You don't see any white men as old as Gitano walking 20 or 30 miles.
Oh, they're tough, all right, Carl agreed.
Say, are you standing up for him, too? Listen, Billy, he explained. I'm having a hard enough time keeping this ranch out of the Bank of Italy without taking on anybody else to feed. You know that, Billy.
Sure I know, said Billy.
If you was rich, it'd be different.
That's right. And it isn't like he didn't have relatives to go to, a brother-in-law and cousins right in Monterey. Why should I worry about him?
Gitano was mysterious, like the mountains. There were ranges back as far as you could see, but behind the last range, piled up against the sky, there was a great unknown country, and Gitano was an old man. Until you got the dull, dark eyes, and in behind them was some unknown thing. Jody felt himself, irresistibly drawn to the bunkhouse. The night was very dark, and far-off noises carried in clearly. Jody picked his way across the dark yard. He could see a light through the window of the little room of the bunkhouse. Because the night was secret, he walked quietly up to the window and peered in. Gitano sat in a rocking chair, and his back was toward the window. His right arm moved slowly back and forth in front of him. Jody pushed the door open and walked in. Gitano jerked upright, and seizing a piece of deer skin, he tried to throw it over the thing in his lap, but the skin slipped away, and Jody stood overwhelmed by the thing he saw in Gitano's hand. A lean and lovely knife with a golden basket hilt. The blade was like a thin ray of dark. The hilt was pierced and intricately carved. "What is it?" Jody demanded. Gitano only looked at him with resentful eyes, and he picked up the fallen deerskin and firmly wrapped the beautiful blade in it. Jody put out his hand. "Can I see it?" Gitano's eyes smoldered angrily, and he shook his head. "Where did you get it? Where did you get it from?"
"I got it from my father."
"Well, where did he get it?" Gitano looked down at the long deerskin in his hand. "I don't know."
"Didn't he ever tell you?"
"No."
"What do you do with it?"
Gitano looked slightly surprised. "Nothing. I just keep it. Can I see it again?" The old man slowly unwrapped the shining blade and let light slip along it for a moment. Then he wrapped it up again. "You go now. I want to go to bed." He blew out the lamp before Jody had closed the door. As he went back toward the house, Jody knew one thing more sharply than he had ever known anything. He must never tell anyone about the knife. It would be a dreadful thing to tell anyone about it, for it would destroy some fragile structure of truth. It was a truth that might be shattered by division. On the way across the dark yard, Jody passed Billy Buck. "They're wondering where you are," Billy said. Jody slipped into the living room, and his father turned to him. "Where have you been?"
"I just went out to see if I caught any rats in the new trap."
"It's time you went to bed." Jody was first at the table in the morning. Then his father came in, and last Billy Buck. Mrs. Tiflin looked in from the kitchen. "Where's the old man?"
"I guess he's out walking," Billy said.
"Maybe he started early to Monterey," said Carl. "It's a long walk."
"No," Billy explained. "His sack is still in the room."
After breakfast, Jody walked down to the bunkhouse. When he was sure no one was watching, Jody went into the little room and looked into Gitano's sack. An extra pair of long cotton underwear was there, an extra pair of jeans, three pairs of worn socks, and nothing else. A sharp loneliness fell on Jody. He walked slowly back from the house. His father stood on the porch talking to Mr. Tiflin.
"I guess old Easter's dead at last. I didn't see him come down to water with the other horses."
In the middle of the morning, Jess Taylor came down from the ridge and rode down.
"You didn't see that old crow bait of yours, did you, Carl?"
"No, of course not. Why?"
"Well, I was out this morning, and I saw a funny thing. I saw an old man on an old horse. No saddle, only a piece of rope for a bridle. He wasn't on the road at all. He was cutting right up through the brush. I think he had a gun. At least I saw something shine in his hand."
"That's old Gitano," Carl Tiflin said. "I'll see if any of my guns were missing."
He stepped into the house for a second.
"Nope. All here."
Which way was he heading, Jess?"
"Well, that's the funny thing. He was heading straight back into the mountains."
They never get too old to steal. I guess he just stole old Easter."
"Want to go after him, Carl?"
"Hell no. Just save me burying that horse. I wonder where he got the gun. I wonder what he wants back there."
Jody walked up through the vegetable patch towards the brush line. He looked searchingly at the towering mountains, ridge after ridge after ridge, until at last there was the ocean. For a moment he thought he could see a black speck crawling up the farthest ridge.
Jody thought of the knife and Gitano, and he thought of the great mountains. A longing caressed him, and it was so sharp that he wanted to cry and get it out of his breast. He lay down in the green grass near the round tub at the brush line. He covered his eyes with his crossed arms and lay there a long time, and he was full of a nameless sorrow.
That's it for Old Hills Radio till next month. Stick around for the Tugboat Captain and Music Through the Night. I'm Carl Schlecht, wishing you a wonderful evening on WDRT Viroqua 91.9 FM.
You are listening to WDRT Viroqua 91.9 FM.
National Bureau of Standards, WWV. When the tone returns, Eastern Standard Time is 8:55 p.m.
Like a grain of sand that wants to be a rolling stone, I want to be the man I'm not and have the things I really haven't got, and that's a lot.
There'll be joy and there'll be laughter. Something big is what I'm after now. Yes, it's what I'm after now. Laughter, a taking, a taker, a giving. Something big is what I'm living for.
Lots of dreams that really should come true before I'm through.
There'll be joy and there'll be laughter. Something big is what I'm after now. Yes, it's what I'm after now. Laughter, a taking, a take up, forgiving. Something big is what I'm living for.